From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Virginia in 1902. That year, the state legislature of Virginia passed a law banning felons from voting. Now, if you're like me, you probably don't know much about state-by-state voting laws for ex-offenders, so here's a quick overview. Most states allow people with felony convictions to vote after they've served their sentences and parole. Some states ban voting until ex-offenders have finished probation. Two states, Maine and Vermont, allow someone with a felony conviction to vote from prison. But Virginia wanted to go further, and in 1902, the state passed a law banning someone with a felony conviction from voting ever. As the Washington Post recently explained, there was a racial undercurrent to that law. One delegate testified that Virginia needed to, quote, eliminate the darkie as a political factor, end quote. Virginia's ban still stands, which brings us to this past April. Governor Terry McAuliffe announced an executive order that would restore voting rights for more than 200,000 felons in his state in time for the November election. McAuliffe said his mission was to strike down the last vestiges of racial exclusion, and he said this order would stand as his proudest achievement in office. But Virginia's state Supreme Court announced in July in a 4-3 ruling that McAuliffe had overstepped his authority as governor, and they struck down the order. McAuliffe responded he would sign individual orders for every single one of the men and women with felony convictions, restoring their voting rights in time for Election Day. Now, it's fair to ask if there's a tinge of politics here. McAuliffe is one of Hillary Clinton's closest friends and advisors. As the Washington Post noted, the vast majority of the votes from this group of citizens are likely to go to Clinton. But McAuliffe responds that Clinton's going to win Virginia with or without them, and for him, this is about justice. Today, nearly a quarter of the black population of Virginia cannot vote because of felony convictions. This hour, a conversation about fairness and justice. We'll talk about voting. We'll also talk about what it means to help ex-offenders, citizens with records, build healthy lives after their incarceration is over. And one of my guests includes a man who served 19 and a half years in prison, 15 at Attica. He's now on parole. That's Dwayne Ponder. And Dwayne, welcome to the program. It's nice to see you here. Thanks for being
here. Thank you for having me.
He is the brother of Danielle Ponder. She is a public defender, Dwayne's sister. We've talked to her about her music, Danielle Ponder and the Tomorrow People. She writes a lot of her art and her music, kind of tackles these kind of themes. And she's kind enough to be here as well, supporting Dwayne and talking to us about your view in the criminal justice system. Nice to see you back here.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
Well, did I hear you say wow during that intro at times there? And how much of that history were you aware of?
I really have just been looking into New York's laws.
Yeah, you're right.
So I didn't realize what was going on with Virginia, but I think what's striking is the 25% of African Americans not being eligible to vote. That is insane. Really, really sad.
And I want to also kind of clear up something that was sticking in my mind before we even really get going here. I'm quoting the governor of Virginia. I'm quoting other journalists. I'm not all that comfortable with the word felon. I like to say people with a felony conviction. Mm-hmm, I don't mm-hmm. want to stamp someone with something permanent. I know, Dwayne, you served your time. So what terminology do you prefer?
You know, when you said it, I was going to say the same thing. Okay. I like to say people with felony convictions and in helping, like even with my clients, I hate when they say, you know, I'm a felon or I'm a three-time felon or I'm a criminal or I'm a this, because that should never be something that identifies you, because it was a moment in time, right? And your life is much bigger than that, and who you are is much bigger than convictions that you might have. So I try to be careful about that language as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. Well, Dwayne, first I want to, before we kind of get into your story, I want to get your take on what you're hearing from Governor McAuliffe. And first, I'd like to play a soundbite from the governor talking to PBS NewsHour back in April when he announced that initial executive order. The Republicans in Virginia were saying, you can't do this, you're overstepping your bounds, that you know law and order matter, and they were pushing back. So he went on PBS NewsHour with Judy Woodruff. You're going to hear part of his explanation for why he signed the order and then her next question to him. Let's listen.
What I did today was to erase 115 years of really repressive tactics used to deprive people their right to vote.
You included convicted felons who were accused of violent crimes, murder, rape. Yes. You didn't make any exceptions. Why not?
Nope. Why should I? Once you have served your time, once you have paid your debt to society, the judge, jury have determined what your sentence would be. Once you complete that, why should you not be back in? When these people, even if they've committed heinous crimes, but once they have finished serving their sentence, they go back to their communities, they get jobs, they have family members. You want them, Judy. I want everybody back getting a job. I want them paying taxes. I want them feeling good about themselves. You've paid your debt to society.
Dwayne, what do you think when you hear that?
I think he sounds like a man with some sense.
Danielle?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that wholeheartedly. I think our criminal justice system, instead of being focused on rehabilitation, is often focused on punishment. And that's what our culture is about, right? You know, we want to see people be punished. And unfortunately, we want them to be punished forever, sometimes it seems, whether it's in discriminating against them in housing and voting and employment. It's like you can never be actually rehabilitated and move on from that moment in your life.
You are on parole, is that right, Dwayne?
Yes.
Okay. And you were out of prison when?
May this year.
May of this year, okay. Yeah. And so forgive me here. I'm trying to make sure I'm current on all of our own laws, et cetera. So on parole, which means you cannot vote in the November election, is that correct?
True.
How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, you feel like... which is why I like what he said. You know, you do your time. You get convicted, you do your time, and then you come home, and then you're expected to move forward. But then it is a shock when you come home and you realize that certain rights have been taken away from you that had nothing to do with your crime or had nothing to do with your punishment. I would have liked to vote, especially knowing that inside those voting booths are questions not just related to the person that you're going to vote for, but questions that affect the community, where a lot of the people... where that community who's been affected, a lot of those people are not even voting. I remember one time going into a voting booth and I seen questions like, do you think it should be legal to walk around with an open beer can? Or do you think it should be legal for guys to stand on a corner and shoot dice? Well, that affected certain people, but those certain people weren't in that booth voting on that. So, you know, I would like to be involved. I would like to be involved in the decision making and, you know, everything in this society. I would like to be involved in that. But unfortunately, I got to stand on the sidelines and watch.
You served 19 and a half years, 15 in Attica. So let's go back a couple of decades. You served that length of a sentence for, what was the conviction?
Robbery in the first degree.
Robbery. And Danielle, I'll kind of defer to both of you because I know I learned about your story from your sister. And your sister has told a lot of stories about her own life and her family through her music. So so we go back to it was robbery, and it was this a multiple offense, or was it a three strike? I'm trying to remember if this was a what did they call it? Three strikes or those? That
right. Persistent felon.
Persistent felon. Yep. Okay. What was going on in your life, you know, at the time?
A lot of things were going on. I'm not going to be specific in detail, sure. But it was a lot of things going on that I didn't deal with, that I didn't address. And then when you don't do that and then you try to repress it, it always surfaces in one way or another. And that's what it was doing, surfacing in one way or another, which stacked up a lot of the crimes.
Were you aware of possible prison sentences? I mean, did you even think in your mind, did you think I could end up in prison?
Yes. Yes, for 20 years, 25 years, absolutely not. Because, at least for me, you think the only people that get 25 years or 20 years is somebody that has killed somebody or has done some serious, heinous crime. You never think that, you know, a low crime, some petty crime person like myself would say, you know, yeah, I just got 20 years. You know, you don't think that. You know, you stole a car here, you got in a fight here, you committed a robbery, $20, $30, and then the next time you go to prison or the next time you catch a charge, which is still, again, less than $2,000, they say, okay, well, here's 20 years, this is your sentence.
And I think it's important for people at home to note that, you know, this is a policy. This is a statute on our books, this mandatory minimums. So it doesn't even allow judges' discretion to look at the crime and say, well, you know, it was $20 that he robbed, right? It becomes, they have to sentence in this way based on your record. And I think I've said this before, but once visiting Dwayne, I was talking about Mamiya and political prisoners. And he was saying, you know, yeah, I'm a political prisoner. And I was like, well, what do you mean by that? But honestly, it's politics that had him in for 20 years. And those people who drafted that legislation are the same people he cannot vote out of office. So, all around, it's unjust.
And Daniel, I think based on my read of history with minimum offense laws and minimum sentences, the idea is deterrence. The idea is, well, if someone has committed a robbery and they know that if they do it again, they could go away for 20 years, they're less likely to do it. In the same way that the death penalty is supposed to be a deterrent for murder. I don't think it's ever been proven. And I'm an evidence guy. I mean, I'm certainly open to the evidence. I'm not sure that's ever been shown to be effective. What do you know about that?
I think we know that prison is not a deterrent. Because there's actual studies that have been done. But, you know, I have clients who've committed 40 petty larcenies and they're on their 41st. And they've gone to prison almost, you know, they've gone to jail almost every time. So we're really looking at, you know, societal issues that are going on. The root causes of people committing crime are often poverty, right? But I do think that there's a race issue to think about when we think about deterrence. Because what we are, I think, saying when we give someone 20 years is not we're trying to deter them from going back in, right? Because that's a good portion of their life, is that we don't see them as useful. We don't think that they will get it together. And we tend to do that with black men. We tend to think that young white youth will kind of get it out of their system. They commit a disorderly conduct or something of that nature. And I've seen this with my own eyes. They will get better offers because the thought is that they'll get it out of their system. But with black men, we really, I think, believe that they are inherently criminal. So when we give someone 20 years to life, I think what they're saying is that you'll probably commit some more crimes in that 20 years, so we're just going to lock you up. So it's not even about the punishment for the crime at hand. It's really throwing someone away and really seeing someone as not contributing ever to society.
Yeah, and yesterday on this program, we had Paul Burgett, who's the vice president of the University of Rochester, who's an African-American. He talked about growing up in St. Louis, being stopped and frisked just because he carried a violin case. He was a kid who played violin, and he said his understanding was police assumed, well, black kids don't play violins. Mm. And he got used to that. And he said that at one point recently he was having a conversation with a student at the U of R, and they said, I wonder what white privilege feels like. And you know what I thought, and I didn't say then, but I'll say now, because one of the things we're talking about here is, does the system treat people differently based on race? Are sentences tinged with race? And let me, before I even go on, let me just go ahead and read this again. 1902, Virginia passed this law to never let people with a felony record to vote again. And one of the delegates testified. This wasn't like, well, I found a private letter that he wrote. This is a testimony of a Virginia delegate in 1902. Quote, we need to eliminate the darky as a political factor. Okay, so obviously there are certain things that have been tinged with race in our history. But so I was growing up, I was 17. Let's see here. Well, 17. I bet you I was 17, maybe 18 years old one summer. Back in Cleveland, where I grew up, I worked down at Chautauqua Lake over the summers, but weekends back there. And was home with friends, bunch of friends at a house party. And we were drinking. We were underage. We were drinking. I don't think we were drinking heavily, but we were drinking. And it's 2 a.m., and what do we want to do? We want to go out to Denny's. You know, it's like what smart kids do who are 18. I know we were 17 because there was curfew. And so six of us pile into my busted up old car. And then a friend of mine said, well, I want to go. I said, there's no room. She said, I'll ride in the trunk. I said, okay, well, that's smart. So there's six of us piled into a car and a girl in the trunk. And we're driving in.
A girl in the trunk?
In the trunk.
Okay.
In the trunk. Yeah. She's in the trunk. And
should you be telling this story, Evan?
I don't. I thought of this yesterday, and I thought, you know, when Paul said, what's white privilege feel like?
Okay.
This is what I thought of, and I didn't bring this up, but this is honest, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and then the rest of the hour is about Dwayne. But I'm only sharing this to say, do you want to know what it feels like to me? We pull up at a stoplight, and the police car pulls up next to us, and I'll still remember the officer's eyes looking at us and saying, wow, there's a lot of people in that car. So we're going, oh my gosh, they're going to pull us over. And so we pull into a little parking lot. We come back out. Sure enough, they're waiting for us. They put their lights on. We're all panicked. 17 years old. We've been drinking. There's six people in the car and there's a girl in the trunk. And we're saying, don't breathe in the trunk. Don't talk. Well, they get us all out of the car. And I didn't think this at the time, but decades later, do you think that if there were six African-Americans in a car pulled over, you know, how would they have been treated, Daniel?
Well, I definitely think a search would have commenced, including the trunk. And then from there, God knows what would have happened.
So we get out, and there's two officers, and they said, what are you guys doing? And they asked our IDs, and they said, you're underage. We probably got to take you down to the station. And then the other officer said, no, let's just ask him. You guys been doing any drugs? And we said, no. And they said, are you going to go right home? We said, yes. And they said, okay, go home. And that was the end of that. Mm. And that's, I don't think I've spoken of it since. But I just feel like looking back at my life, what a stupid thing to do, but what a privileged result for me.
Mm-hmm.
What an absolutely privileged result. I can't imagine if I were an African-American with five African-American friends or a Latino or whatever it is, that it would have turned out the same way.
Right. I agree. Definitely.
That's what I thought when I thought, what is privilege? For that? So Paul Burgett said that yesterday, and I thought, I don't know why, but that's what came up in my mind. So now here we are, and we're looking at history of race and how it factors into convictions, arrests, sentencing. And Dwayne, I'm not absolving. I mean, I don't know. Again, I don't know a lot about your own record, and I'm not sitting here saying what you did wasn't significant. But again, we're talking about minimum sentences. So share as much as you want here. The robbery that you committed that set off that minimum sentence. I mean, do you remember what it was for? What were you stealing?
Yes, I do. Yeah. Actually, I was going with some friends of mine, and they had this master plan, like, you know, every crime has a master plan, and it didn't work. And I don't want to get into specifics.
Okay. That's fine.
And it was a robbery, and we got caught. And pretty much, you know, you go to jail and you go to trial. And, you know, and the bottom line was I got 20 years. A co-defendant of mine got a cop out of 5 years. And another co-defendant got 16 years, all for the same crime. For me, it was like we were just talking about earlier, because you got a criminal record. At the time of sentencing, my lawyer was asking the judge, she said, this is just too much time for somebody that's just committed a robbery. He said, he's about to get sentenced as if he just killed somebody. The judge in return said, I know, but there's nothing that I can do about it because I'm bound by law. So even if I wanted to lower the sentence, I can only go to 20. I can't go no less than that. The prosecutor at the time basically was saying the same thing. Well, we'll definitely agree with the minimum sentence, which is 20. And my lawyer, still defending me, said, yeah, of course you're going to agree with the minimum sentence. That's 20 years of this man's life for a robbery. So, you know, like Danielle was saying earlier, you know, the judge is bound by law. He's bound by that statute, that sentencing guideline that says if you do this many crimes, then you get this much time.
Dwayne, at what point did it really sink into you that you were going to spend that much time in prison? Did it happen right away, or was there some denial that we'll find something out of this? Behavior, something, you know. When did it really sink in that you were going to spend that much time in prison?
You know, the system worked in a funny kind of way, because you do have a legal system where you can appeal a case. And then after that, you could put in another motion to get a reversal on your case, meaning that you can come back down to court and go to trial again or get another cop out, or they just dismiss the case. So it has these things in line to where even if you have 40 years, you're really not thinking about doing that 40 years, because there's motions that you can use. There's, you know, different ways of gaining your freedom. So you read in the law how this guy that had 120 years, maybe he got a reversal. So every prisoner with a lot of years is always thinking, one day is going to be me. I don't think no prisoner sits in prison and say, yeah, well, I'm just going to do this 25 years. No, he's going to the law library. He's fighting his case. He's arguing different motions. So, and that was the case for me. So I spent years doing litigation, asking Danielle questions, talking to anybody that I knew that knew anything about the law. So I never sat and said, okay, I got 18 or 16 or 15 years left. The only time it really did hit me, and this is it's something. The only time it really did hit me is when my time started becoming like maybe 4 years, 5 years, 3 years, and I said, oh my goodness, I'm about to go to the parole board. And then that's when you not look back, but you realize that, okay, it's no more time for motions. When I came home and I seen, you know, you see buildings, they tear them down, they build them up. So that's really nothing new. You seen cars before, so that's really nothing new. But when you see your niece, or when you see a nephew that you didn't see in 19 and a half years, and you see he got a beard all around his face, you see he driving a car, may have a house, then it sinks in. I've been gone 19 and a half years. Because you start seeing that change right there in your face. If you and I were around each other every day for 19 years, I really can't see you getting older. I'm always going to see you at the age you are right now. You're always going to see me at the age I am right now because we're around each other every day. And that's how it is in prison. You're around somebody every day. You really don't see how much that time has affected everybody around you and yourself included.
So now you're working?
Absolutely. Which is, I'm blessed. I'm really blessed. I got a wonderful family. I got an excellent, smart-minded brother. One of the things that guys don't get when they come home is a brother like mine. Most times they get welfare, and sometimes they go home to nothing. Just so happened I have an excellent brother, sharp-minded. When I came home, he said, all right, look in the garage. In the garage was all kind of tools. He had T-shirts, business cards, flyers for Quality Touch Remodeling. He had a road map, a plan. This is what we're going to do because you will never leave me again. We got into, started doing construction. He learned a lot. I learned a lot from my dad. We both did. He learned even more because he's been around my dad for a long time. So he knows so much about the business. And we've been progressing. We've been going, and we've been making good things happen.
That's wonderful, and it's remarkable. And I think you're recognizing your own privilege is maybe the right word in this case, to at least have that support when you get out of prison.
Absolutely.
Because in this case, Dwayne, you know, I am concerned that we treat incarceration, as your sister said, just as punishment, as opposed to recognizing that these are human beings and we want them to live productive lives. We want them to live happy lives. We want them to feel integrated back into our communities.
Absolutely.
And so from your perspective, having served all of those years in prison, almost 2 decades in prison, is there enough emphasis on what happens to help people? If you didn't have your brother, that you'd be in a different, well, you'd have Danielle. But let's just say you're an only child. Or think about other people who you met in prison, right? So is there enough going on inside to make sure when your time's done, you're gonna get yourself a chance to work, to be productive, that recidivism is not going to happen? You know, is there enough going on that way?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It's two ways that a system operates. The way that system is on paper, and then the way that system is when you actually get there. And that is probably with all systems, including the DOCCS. So it's a way that the system operates.
Department of Corrections.
Right, Department of Corrections. So it's a way that prisons run that's on paper. And that's usually the way that people see it. And then it's a way that prisons run that's not on paper. So, and to answer your question, so here I am, a guy from the city of Rochester, where all these crimes happen. I've never seen nobody get shot. I've never seen no one get stabbed. I've never seen no one get cut. And then I go to a prison and I see someone get shot with an automatic rifle, like maybe 50 feet away. I see someone get stabbed. I see someone get cut. This is the stuff that's inside the system. So you fighting all this, you dealing with all this, along with other stuff that's bought at you. And then one day they say, all right, go home. Go home to what? Go home with what? Who did you have in place for me to talk to about that dead body? And I forgot this. I've never seen any dead bodies in my neighborhood. Unless we went to a funeral.
But you did in prison.
Yes. It was 11:58 at night. I can't remember the day, but that body rolled across my cell on a water cart. But you don't, I was never exposed to that. So you see that kind of stuff. What is being put in gear for you to deal with all the things that are going on in that little society? Not too much. You can't say, okay, well here, you can go learn how to build a cabinet made of wood. That's not gonna cut it, because there's so much more going on inside that system, but you can't see it. It was so much going on with inside police departments and happening against citizens, but nobody saw it because technology wasn't advanced like that yet for you to see it. Then one day happening, technology became advanced. And then you had smartphones and all kind of other phones that I can't name. But you had all kind of phones where you can capture that stuff. Yeah. So people started seeing it and believing it. And it's the same way with inside a prison. So it's not a lot of things really set in motion for you to come home and be all right. Aside from, you got 45 days to go home here. You can fill out this social service paper. Fill it out now. When you get home, they'll give you $129 food stamps, and they'll also give you maybe $120-something of cash so you can do something with. Do what? Maybe a night at the hotel, and you can buy you a couple of dinners for it, and you'll be all right. But that's pretty much all you got. And I know a lot of guys that are not as fortunate to have a family. I know a lot of guys that don't have families. A guy I know just came home after doing 30-something years. He has no family. Everybody that he knows has died, except his daughter. And his daughter's been estranged from him, so she really doesn't know him, doesn't really want him to be around. What is he going to do? What did they have in place for him to do? Cutting grass every day wasn't going to cut it. Cleaning the windows and being a trustee, porter, whatever, that is not going to help him now. So, you know, there needs to be more than just conversation, because that's a word that's used a lot. It needs to be more than just conversation on giving a prisoner something to have when he can come home, something that he can really have and stand on, aside from just mopping and sweeping.
Dwayne, did you get the sense that the people who worked in the system, from guards to everybody else, did they expect people with felony records to reoffend? Did they expect to see people like you again?
Now, I said when I got on the show, I was going to be real careful because I'm still on parole. So
you don't have to answer any question you don't want to.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you'll hear that all over the place. You'll hear that from prisoners. You'll hear that from officers. You'll hear it from everybody. You know, you always hear that. I mean, and that's what we do. We look at the news and we see somebody that's been apprehended by the police, and the first thing that we say is, oh, yeah, he's done. He's out. He's never going to get his freedom again, or whatever the case. Yet, we were not there. We didn't know anything. The man never even picked a jury yet, and we already deciding his fate. So that's what we do as people. So now you're inside of a prison, and then you think that somebody's not going to continue on being human? Yes, he's going to be human, and he's going to say, yeah, he's going to go home. He's going to mess up. It's going to happen. You know, you see somebody in the streets, and because you don't like the way they dress or you don't like the way that they dealt with you, they say, yeah, he'll be in jail in 2 weeks. You know, just being judgmental. So were there people in there that were judgmental? Of course.
We're talking to Dwayne Ponder and his sister Danielle Ponder. Dwayne is a Rochesterian, and as of May, he is out of prison. He spent 19 and a half years in prison. And we're talking to him about reintegration. Now, the seed for this conversation was Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, who decided earlier this year that he wanted to sign an executive order changing Virginia laws about allowing people with felony records to vote. Virginia bars people with felony records from ever voting, one of the strictest states in the country. New York State will allow you to vote if you have a felony record, if you've served your time, if you serve parole and probation. So Dwayne will not be able to vote in November. But the question is, you know, that's a small component of reintegration, of caring about people, about making sure they have opportunity. I see the phone's ringing, so let's do this. Let's get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back, and we'll take some of your phone calls. If you want to call the program and weigh in, from everything from people with felony voting records. Do you think Governor McAuliffe is making the right call in Virginia? Should we be more lenient in New York State? Should we be tougher? Is Governor McAuliffe making the wrong call? And if you want to weigh in on that way, that's fine too. Dwayne Ponder and Danielle Ponder is his sister. She's a public defender. And we're talking about these issues with you. 844-295-TALK, toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. We're right back. Coming up in our second hour, two candidates for federal office join us to talk about their policy and platforms and ideas. We'll start with John Plum, a Democrat running for U.S. Congress against incumbent Tom Reed. Then in our second half hour, Alex Merced, the Libertarian running for U.S. Senate. Talk to both of the candidates about what they'd like to do and why they want your vote next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and let me start with your phone calls in our second half hour. Mark in Rochester, first up. Go ahead, Mark.
Hey, hi. Thank you. First of all, I want to appreciate your comment yesterday when you turned off the phone on the person that started ranting.
The white supremacist.
Yes, yeah, and yeah. You did it respectfully, so I just want to give you props. You are very good. My point today, though, is all the things that we're talking about when folks talk about injustice to black people usually get focused on the criminal justice system, and that's important, but it's also somewhat insidious in that it defines black people as, are you a criminal or not? And I say that in that I'm almost 60 years old. I'm in Rochester now. I grew up in New Jersey. My father was a doctorate of chemistry. He was literally a rocket scientist. And we had to pick when we went on vacation where we could go because there were places that did not allow blacks. And that was not slavery days. This is in my lifetime. And so we focus very much on the criminal justice system, which we need to, but it can also help allow people to not view the other things that are more subtle, that are less violent, but that are as virulent, where you can live, what you're charged for things, what is your, just various things. So I'll stop here because I don't want to ramble, but I just want to add that to the discussion, if that makes sense.
Mark, thanks for the phone call. Dwayne, go ahead. Dwayne Ponder wants to start.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree with what he just said, which is why I was listening to your show the other day, which is why I really seen how important it was when you had the soccer crew here and their father and
the World of Inquiry school students who knelt during the national anthem.
Yes. And they were talking about the same injustices, but just coming from a different point of view. You know, so what he was saying, I definitely agree with. You know, it just happened to be that today is about, the criminal justice system. Right.
But I take Mark's point that it shouldn't dominate every conversation about when we talk about racial equality, when we talk about racism, structural racism. It certainly goes beyond the criminal justice system. So Mark, point taken on that. Go ahead, Daniel.
I think, and I understand what he was also trying to acknowledge, that there are there's different experiences. So if you take me and Dwayne, we both grew up in the same neighborhood. We had two different paths. So I, as a black woman who went to law school, have different experiences, but still have experienced racism, right? And then Dwayne, as someone who's been incarcerated, has experienced a different level of racism. So I think, yes, we're focusing on the criminal justice system right now, but I think he's right, is that there are many experiences that people of color have as far as racial injustice is concerned.
No question. And before I get back to your phone calls, let me just extend that part of Mark's comment, because we could talk about job hiring in general, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this has been studied. If you take the name Craig and you change it to a name with a more historically African-American connotation, the callbacks kind of cut in half, things like that. So in general, we know that it's harder for non-white people in this country just to get callbacks for jobs, whether you have to check a box that says you have a criminal record or not. But then I think this conversation should at least include a brief discussion on banning the box, because when we talk about banning the box, we're talking about job applications that always include that, you know, have you ever been convicted of a crime? And if you check that box, you're almost certainly not going to get a call back. No one is saying that employers should never be allowed to know anything about you, but the question is, if they're disqualifying you right out of the gate? You know, should they find out later in the process, if they decide someone like Dwayne Ponder or anybody who has served time would be a damn good candidate, and, you know, are we excluding them? Well, on this question of banning the box, the Wall Street Journal had a story on this past Monday. And let me just read from the Wall Street Journal, and we'll get our guest take on it. They say, "No research suggests that ban the box laws, so-called because they eliminate a box on many job applications about criminal records, can create a wider racial gap when it comes to which applicants are interviewed and hired. In one study, employers appeared to screen out African-American candidates just based on their names, and the callback gap with white applicants widened after ban the box laws took effect. Another study looked at Labor Department data and found fewer young, low-skilled Hispanic and black men were employed in U.S. regions that had adopted ban the box policies." And here's what Sonia Starr said. She is a University of Michigan School of Law professor who studied the introduction of ban the box laws in New York City and New Jersey. Quote, "Employers may tend, absent information to the contrary, to assume that all black applicants have criminal records and white applicants do not," end quote. So there's something perverse about this that says the intention is to make it more of a level playing field for skilled workers, regardless of a criminal record. And instead, if you take away that box, employers may just assume, well, I'm just going to assume anybody who's non-white probably has a record. And so to me, I guess, Daniel, my first reaction was not, well, then we should not do ban the box. My reaction to that is, what does that say about us as a society? And what structural racism is, and the assumptions we make, but what do you make of that?
Oh, it's so overwhelming, Evan. It's so overwhelming. Like, racism is so deeply embedded into our culture and so deeply codified into our institutions. And I'm going to try to articulate this well because I was just thinking of so many different things, but there are systems in place. So there's this quote that I've seen somewhere that said that America should be happy that black people just want equality and not revenge. And I do believe that there's this underlining fear that black people will be so enraged and so upset that they'll take over. And it's this fear kind of exists in all different spaces, right? The fear of a black planet, right? So in the police system, as it is set up in our community, is set up as an overseer in the black community. And it has been this way for years, right? So the reason we had things like the black codes and the black police walking the streets in the black community was to keep those people at bay, right? And then that turned into incarcerating people. So now, once we incarcerate people, we take certain rights away from them. We make it difficult for them to get housing, difficult for them to have jobs. We make it difficult, or they can't vote at all once they're incarcerated in New York State. So there is this way of overseeing the black community and the black race, a way of marginalizing and continuing to oppress them. And I hate to keep talking about the criminal justice system, but from police to the jails, that is one of the biggest things America uses to oppress the black community. So I don't really know the frustrations I have. I can't even really express them on air because I'm feeling less and less hopeful about our ability to undo thinking, right?
Here's why I want you to feel more hopeful.
Okay.
This is not me white-splaining, okay? I promise. But I want you, as someone who respects you and admires you, I want you to feel more hopeful because I can tell you, when I grew up in schools, in public radio that I was listening to at a young age, et cetera, most of these conversations were not happening at all. Now, Dwayne said something earlier this hour, which is important. Conversation's nice. Where's mm-hmm. Where's the action? Mm-hmm. I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, is that fair, Dwayne?
Absolutely.
Okay, so, but I think we are way more cognizant of this. And I think what was under the surface that was sort of tamped down started to come up when President Obama was first elected. Now, of course, I think it's being stoked in dangerous ways. But so there's a lot more of that as an undercurrent than I probably wanted to admit is there. But we are at least getting much more open-eyed about this. And because I think, you know, the 90s especially, it was like this Disney World land of everything is great and pretending that there were no problems, you know. And I don't think, I think at least that has to start with this. Are we going to grapple with it? Are we going to be honest about it? Can we talk about it? Mm. Danielle was on in this past May when we talked about Beyonce and Lemonade. And you talked about how even that was this cultural moment that was a signal to black women that you're allowed to have genuine emotion and that you can cut it loose a little bit. So I think these conversations are at least happening. Do they lead to action? I don't know. But look at Terry McAuliffe. Look at there are certain things that are at least pushing it in some way. And is there more resistance than you'd like to see? Definitely. But I don't think 10, 20 years ago, a lot of these things were even addressed. So
I think you're right. But I'm concerned about implicit bias. I'm concerned about inherent racism. I'm concerned about the comments section. Okay.
Yeah. No.
Before Donald Trump came along, did we know that all of these people existed? So, I mean, did we see it so much in our face, right? But anyway, I think my point more so is I'm really, you know, interested in making systemic changes. And it seems like the system always reinvents a way to oppress. Okay, so if we can't have a box that says, are you a felon or not? Now we'll just go by, well, you're black, so you may have a criminal record. Or if we can't, you know, enslave you, now we'll just have the 13th Amendment and we'll incarcerate you. If we can't, so it always seems that there will be a way globally to oppress the darker people of this world. And I want to believe that we can do different, but it gets overwhelming, and I'm just being real with you, and I really don't care who hears it. Like, it gets overwhelming. It gets frustrating. How long, as black people, must we try to convince white people that we are human beings and that we deserve equality? And that is a overwhelming and frustrating task to undertake. And I think many people of color are, you know, not feeling hopeful about our ability to do that. I mean, look at the way people treated the kids who just took a knee. Okay, for the national anthem. Listen to the comments. Listen to, and yes, there were people saying positive things, but beyond that, look at our system. Look at our criminal justice system. It is still a completely racist institution and has been for years. Look at the police force. It still is an institution that applies racist policies right here in Rochester every day. I just had a recent client who was stopped for no bell on his bike, and then he was searched. That does not happen anywhere else in Rochester but in the hood, right? So it's great that I have amazing white friends who share articles and who ask me, how can I help, how can I help? But the powers that be still seem to be in a place of upholding racist institutions.
Let me.
Melancholy.
We got 6 minutes. I'm going to try to get through as many listener comments because I got a lot here. Okay, Misty wants to know, what do you say in situations like the Xerox Credit Union case, where the suspect had a record, violent even, and he was given a second chance? He was hired by Xerox, worked there for years before he allegedly took revenge for losing a lawsuit. Granted, that's one case, but it's not a complete outlier. And you will have people say that why did Xerox hire him in the first place?
I say nothing because she just said allegedly, and he hasn't had a trial and he hasn't been convicted of anything. And I think that's exactly what Dwayne was saying before. We love to pass judgment. We love to immediately say people should be thrown under the jail. And we know nothing about this case, and we are not the jury.
But come on, Misty, are there white people who have ever been given a second chance and committed violence? She's pointing to one story. Mm-hmm. I don't know what statement on society we're trying to make with one story. Is the Xerox case indicative of the black community?
Here's a really interesting thing for her to think about. If she's really concerned about public safety and she's really concerned about people reoffending, then she should be working to get to the root causes of the problems. So Misty should be volunteering to help eradicate poverty, or that should be her life goal if she's concerned about things happening again. What happens is we say, well, you know, he stole before and he's going to steal again. And you know why he's probably going to steal again? Because he's addicted to heroin. And what are we doing to help him with the addiction? Or he sold drugs before, he's going to sell drugs again. And that's probably because he doesn't have a job. So what are we doing to make sure that our youth are employed? People want public safety, but they don't want to get to the root causes of the problem. If you're concerned about public safety, then be concerned about poverty, because that's what leads to crime.
All right, let me try to get, we're going to try to move quickly here. So if I come to you, keep it tight. Michael in Brighton. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi. First of all, I wanted to ask about the 45th anniversary of the Attica uprising, which was a month ago. There was a national prisoners strike. So I'm interested if you can shed some light on the conditions in places like Attica that would cause prisoners to want to organize and go on strike. And I just want to also mention that Dwayne did some work at my house a few months ago, did an excellent job, and I urge people to hire him and other people that are, you know, out of prison.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for the phone call. Dwayne's got a smile on his face on that one, but he's asking about conditions. Okay, so if you missed it, Dwayne served 15 of his 19 and a half years in Attica. How are conditions?
Huh.
Remember, he's on parole. He's being careful.
The conditions are in Attica now, I don't know. The last thing that I did know was that they put cameras up everywhere. In the hallways, in the mess halls, or whatever. At one time, they ordered 71. When I was there, they did order 71 cameras. They took those 71 cameras and they put them in the mess hall, aka the cafeteria. What happens in the cafeteria? Nothing. People eat. That's what happens. What does the stuff happen in the yards, in the hallways? So they took all those cameras and put them in the mess hall so they can sit and watch people eat. Anyway. So the conditions now, I'm really not sure. The conditions that led to the Attica 1971 riot. Blacking out return addresses on phones, not giving you tissue when you use the bathroom, taking people in the basement, handcuffing them to the chair, beating them up, all kind of stuff. That was the thing that led to the Attica 1971 riot. To have another rebellion, I'm quite sure it's not because the prices are too high in commissary and you're not making enough money. I'm quite sure it's not because nobody is opening the window and it's a hot summer day. So you think about, if you know what happened the first time and you believe in that history repeats itself, then you can pretty much get an idea of what's happening around the second time. If there's to be, I think I've seen somewhere on the internet, prisoners in Attica still rebelling. Why? Well, why did they rebel the first time? So history probably repeating itself.
Drew in Rochester, next up. Go ahead, Drew.
I work with individuals who are on parole, and what I tell them when I come in contact with them, I tell them, if it's not on your paperwork of release stating what you can do and can't do, then you should vote. And let the Board of Education, the Board of Elections figure it out. I still tell these guys, you need to register to vote whether you're a convicted felon or not, because if it's not on your probation or parole release papers, you should go ahead and register to vote.
Drew, thank you. Thoughts, Dwayne?
No, I think that's good. I mean, if that will get you to be able to vote, then all right, let's go for it. Let's register to vote and vote.
Well, we're down to our last minute here, and I just want to thank Dwayne for being very open about his story. Are you feeling, this is sort of a strange question, I don't know how to ask this other than, are you feeling pretty stable now? Are you feeling like life is, you have a pretty good idea of the road in front of you now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm glad you asked that question a lot. How you doing, Jen? I promise I'll do that. How you doing, Kieran Kadai?
You can shout out to whoever you want. That's right.
A lot of people say, you know, how have you adjusted to society, and they ask me that. And I always get the same response. I wasn't born in prison. I was born here in society, so I know about society. I know how to drive on the right side of the road. You know, I know about that kind of stuff.
But when you were incarcerated, there was basically no internet. That's crazy to me. I mean, that's a long time.
Yes.
It's a lot to adjust to.
The internet was what you heard somebody else say while you were in the guy. That was the internet. But, you know, it's the prison that you can't adjust to. So, you know, I appreciate you having me. And maybe in a couple of years when I get off parole, I'd like to come back.
Well,
and have the same topic, all right?
You're welcome.
All right. When I'm off parole.
Let's do that. In the meantime, let's grab lunch sometime.
Absolutely.
I'd love that, Dwayne.
I'll be willing to do that.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
And thank you for your time. Danielle, it's always an honor to have you.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
Great to see you. More connections right after this break.